who gave me a book for my birthday back in November, a biography of Winston Churchill. And I enjoyed reading it, but it was very one-sided. And I could see the writer, he always put Churchill in the best possible light and excused his mistakes. And the problem with Winston Churchill is, like many heroes, many great people, he had lots of flaws. He had great strengths, but also some great weaknesses. He did some crazy things sometimes. The politician Enoch Powell once said, "All political careers end in failure." Rather a gloomy statement, isn't it? Perhaps he overstates the negative, but I think there's something true about it. You know, all people, great people, they often have great mistakes. Not easy being a politician, not being a leader. Often people can easily remember your mistakes and blame you for them, hold them against you, never remember if you did anything good. And of course, it's not just true for politicians. It's probably in some ways just as true for us. You know, our lives might include successes, things we're proud of, but if honest, there'll be things we regret, we wish we hadn't done as well. We've been looking through February at some of these kings of Judah in 2 Chronicles. You know, our leaders in this nation are in times of turmoil, times of uncertainty. We're not quite sure what's happening. And the nation of Israel and Judah in turmoil. The nation has split into two. The northern half has left the southern half. We look at some of their leaders. They were a mixed bag. Some were good, some were bad. Some, like Asa today, you know, were a bit of a mixture. You know? As a leader, he begins well, but his career ends badly. In a way, you look at him and he feels very real, doesn't he? So I want to look at him, see, what does he do that's good? Where does he go wrong? Why does his time as a king end in failure? Well, do turn to page 447. You can follow chapter 14, 2 Chronicles, and follow what I'm saying. He begins well. He removes the barriers to people seeking God. Verse 3. He cut down the foreign altars, the high places, smashed the sacred stones, cut down the Asherah poles. These are the places of worship that belong to the nations around Israel. People worship to the gods. It seems rather intolerant, doesn't it? Can you hear people today saying, you know, or then saying, Yahweh, Asherah, Baal, it's all the same. Aren't they just different faces of the same God? You know, they have their way, we have our way. You know, don't we just need to be tolerant and really work at getting on with our neighbours? Can't you just feel the spirituality when you gather around the sacred stone? God is here. I sat on a discussion about evangelism with some people this week. And someone said, I have a big problem with saying Jesus is the only way to God. The issues then are the issues today. Why does it matter? I think it's a matter of loyalty. It's a personal thing. Also knew that God had specifically revealed himself to Israel. He made what's called a covenant. He'd given them lands. He'd rescued them from Egypt. He'd been with them through 40 years through the desert when they'd rebelled and done terrible things, but he stuck with them. He gave them a country to live in. And then time and time again, when they were in distress, they'd prayed, they'd turned to God, and he was there. And God simply wasn't a God, but he had a name, a personal name. That was Yahweh. If you look in your Bibles, you see sometimes it refers to God, G-O-D, but sometimes God's referred to by another name, Lord. Lord in capitals. And that's when it's using his personal name, Yahweh. You know, God had chosen to personally share his name with people. If you like, he'd said, you can be on first name terms with me. He'd blessed them, the other existence to him. So to worship another God was unfaithfulness. It was spiritual adultery. Adultery and faithfulness in a relationship shocks people. It wounds, it destroys. How much more with God? When we're spiritually unfaithful. When all these other articles of worship were around, the sacred stones, the incense altars, it split people's loyalties. And rightly, aroused the anger of God. It got in the way of the relationship with God. So by removing them, also does something that makes it more possible for people to have a relationship with God. In a sense, he removes the thing on the surface, their hearts actually have to turn to him as well. But part of the consequence of this is peace with God. And when there's peace with God, you read verse 5, there's peace with the neighbours. You know, and there's prosperity. The towns in the country are built up. It's a good time. There was a teacher once who wanted to make his students think. So he took a bucket and he filled it full of bricks. And when it was full of bricks, he said to the students, "Is there space for anything else?" "No," they said. So he took a big bag of gravel from builders' merchants and poured the gravel into the bucket. And of course, the gravel filled in all the gaps between the stones, between the bricks. And then he said, asked the students the same question again. "Is there space for anything else?" And most of them said no. One or two of them said yes. So he took a big bag of sand and he poured it into the bucket. And of course, it filled in the gaps between the gravel and the bricks. And he asked the question again, "Is there space for anything else?" And they were beginning to understand by this time, and they said no. Yes, there is space. So he got a bucket of water. Of course, there was plenty of space for the bucket of water to go in as well. And the teacher said, that "This is what I'm telling you, it's about priorities. Put the big things in first. You know, if you start with the water, you can't put the bricks in. Put the big things in first." And it's the same with us. If there's no space for God sometimes in our life, because the big things that we put in our lives, you know, are big things other than God. The big things are often good things. You know, family, health, hobbies, working hard. You know, but when they come first, when they're the ultimate thing, they become idols. They become more important than God. We mustn't bow down to them. We only bow down to God because he is God. Like Israel, he's invited us into a personal relationship with him. He said, you know, "Come and know me on first name terms. Know me. You know, most idols aren't big, ugly statues in our lives. They're something good that's become the ultimate thing. And what we've got to do is put the first things first. Put the big things in first, our relationship with God in first, and the other things will fit round it in the right place. In our lives, in the life of Judah, the biggest thing was God. Also puts God first. Nothing must come in the way of that. And for ourselves, you know, when we look at all the political uncertainties, we're not quite sure what's going to happen, are we? You know, in about 2 months' time with Brexit. Here's the most important thing for our nation above all: pro-Brexit, anti-Brexit. We need to be a nation, first of all, that seeks God, that puts the big things in their place. So also kind of brings the nation back to God, and he puts this into practice. He's an example of relying on God. If you look at the second half of chapter 14, verse 8, there's a crisis. Now, also has a strong army. It gives some figures: 300,000 men in Judah, 180,000 in Benjamin. Sounds like a large army. It is a reasonable size army. Though note, the word for thousand might also be translated military unit or clan or family, something like that. So it's probably not 480,000 men, it's probably 480 units of men. The thing is, however, the army of Zerah the Cushite, verse 9, is bigger. Thousands on thousands. It's huge, perhaps twice as big. And he has chariots as well. You know, the nation is about to be completely overwhelmed. But nevertheless, Orsa bravely goes out into battle. And what happens next shows the sort of man that he is. Verse 11, he prays, "Lord, there is no one like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, Lord our God, for we rely on you. In your name we have come against this vast army. Lord, you're our God. Do not let mere mortals prevail against you." His prayer is a sort of mixture of weakness. We're weak. And this army is vast. It's huge. It's a mixture of weakness but also great confidence. He looks to God. We rely on you. Do not let mere mortals prevail. Yeah, for us, the conflict is not of one army against another army. You know, really, in the end, it's God versus man. And for the sake of God's honour, he says, mortal man must not win. I think prayers that honour God, God honours. And so Judah is completely victorious. The size of the opposing army that seems so relevant, that seems so massive, actually is irrelevant when God is in the picture. Now what it says when we say that Orsa relied on God, it doesn't mean that he didn't use normal, natural human means. He prays and he goes out to meet the army, the invaders. There is a sort of super spirituality sometimes that wants to see God only at work through the supernatural. You know, God only worked through miraculous healing, and if doctors help you, well, that's a bit of a second best. That's, you know, or only at work through prophecy and very dramatic revelation, and not simply at work through daily reading scriptures. I think Oliver Cromwell got the balance right when he said to his troops in the English Civil War, pray and keep your powder dry. Keep your gunpowder dry. Pray and keep your powder dry. So what do we make of this for ourselves today? You know, Judah is not our nation. You know, we're not the people of God. The people of God is the church. In the First World War, both sides went to war with the blessings of their churches. The German helmets were inscribed with the words, Gott mit uns, God with us. And yet there were many in Britain, you know, many in Britain passionately believed, God is on our side, God is on our side. And yet whose side was God on? We can't sort of control God and sort of, you know, throw out a treaty to him and say, look, you are our ally, God, you must do what we want. This week we've had Donald Tusk, the EU president, rather unhelpfully saying there's a special place reserved in hell for hard Brexiteers. I'm not quite sure what he means by that. I suspect he's not really speaking theologically, but it prompts us to ask the question, whose side is God on? Because I have read things that really, you know, people are saying, you know, God is on our side. God is on the side of Brexit, for instance. I read something like that yesterday. When we demonise those who disagree with us or claim is on our side, God is on our side, I think we're sort of using God. We're demeaning God, actually. He's God. We're just, you know, fallible human beings. We're mortal. It doesn't mean there's not rights or wrongs in a situation. It doesn't mean there's better or worse situations. But God is not there to be used by us to justify what we want. Orsa's got a right view of God. He came to humbly recognise that God is God. You know, we're just men and women. He's the one who made everything out of nothing like that. So Orsa wasn't successful because he got God on his side, because he was good at lobbying, because he twisted God's arm to vote for him. You know, no, he was successful because he realised that without God he was nothing. You know, he was powerless against this mighty army. And when he says he relies on God, it's not kind of saying like you rely on your God, your car to start, you rely on your car to get to work. You know, it's inconvenient if it doesn't do that. Rather, I think he's saying more, he threw himself on God. And he knew without God, he was nothing. Let's just think about that personally for ourselves. I was with someone this week, a mother and a baby. And we were going somewhere for a meeting. And we walked there, and the baby cried all the way there in the pram, you know. And when you hear that continuous wailing, it goes out to your heart, doesn't it? You think, I must do something to stop it. I must do something to stop it. What do I do to stop it? How do I comfort this child? And there's the problem with babies, of course. You never know quite sure what is causing them to cry, you know. And you're helpless. You don't know what to do. That kind of helplessness is the essence of what prayer is. You know, when we cry out to God and say simply help, God, like the father, the mother, hears. And because he's infinitely wise, he knows exactly, precisely how to help us. And I wonder, are our prayers sometimes quite weak because we're not helpless, or at least we don't really recognise our helplessness? It's not so much we're praying, we're sort of giving God an agenda and asking him to sort of agree to it, sort of thing. Or sometimes we're too proud to admit our helplessness. And that's at the heart of prayer. Sometimes when we pray, I think, you know, we actually need to spend quite a bit of time realising what we can't do, realising how much depends on God. And that takes time. You know, so maybe you sit down for 20 minutes, you spend the first 90 minutes realising that, recognising that, admitting to God, acknowledging all the things over which actually he is in charge. And then in the last minute, you're ready to ask God, this is what needs to be done. We've brought ourselves into a position, into the right position to pray. A position of helplessness, dependence on God. I think also recognise this. It says in the Psalms, Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, the labourers labour in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand guard in vain. He knew that that was true. So far, so good. But turn to chapter 16, over a page. And the story doesn't end well. He's been king for a long time, maybe 36 years. And Baasha, king of Israel, it says, fortified Ramah to prevent anyone from leaving or entering the territory of Asa, king of Judah. The city of Ramah was only 5 miles north of Jerusalem. It controlled the main road, the trade route north. If you like, it was an Israel-Judah hard border. You know, those things matter to people. It was a threat. It was provocative. So what does also this godly, godly king do? Does he pray? Does he call the nation to turn to God? Despite all his experience, no. Instead, he takes the silver and gold from the temple, you see verse 2, and sends it to a king north of Israel, the king of Aram. And so now Israel is trapped with hostile people south and north. And as a result, King Baasha rethinks his policy. He abandons the work, verse 5. And there is success. And actually success was the worst possible thing that could have happened. That's a subtle trap, isn't it? We justify things because they work. Because it works, it must be right. Sometimes God allows things to work, but it doesn't mean they're right. The judge of whether something is right or not is God. So verse 7, a prophet named Hanani comes and rebukes Orser. He says, you relied on the king of Aram and not the Lord your God. And reminds him of what has happened in the past. Were not the Cushites and the Libyans a mighty army with great numbers of chariots and horsemen? You know, yet when you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand. That was the problem. Orser didn't rely on God. In some ways, it seems like a very small sin, doesn't it? Not something anyone would notice. It's not like he's lying, murdering, committing adultery, kidnapping, you know, all sorts of evil things. You know, it's a sort of sin that people commit every day. They just ignore God. It seems so, in some ways, so innocent, so trivial. Later on, also gets a terrible disease in the feet. You can read about it at the end of chapter 16. Very severe. And tragically, it says, verse 12, even in his illness, he did not seek help from the Lord, only from doctors. Now, God has nothing against doctors. It wasn't wrong that he sought help from doctors or he sought help from medicine. That wasn't what it was. But rather, that he didn't seek God. You know, it was what he didn't do. It was what he left out that was the problem. His sin was ungodliness, living as if God wasn't there. You know, and perhaps another dimension. This is not relying on not relying on God, relying on the foreign king might have meant that he had to enter a treaty with this king, offer sacrifices. You know, perhaps he was entering into spiritual adultery. But the question is, why does he do this? You know, he's been such a good man, an exemplary leader. The nation has prospered. He knows God. He has a real relationship with God. Why does he do it? It's a mystery, isn't it? Why? Two thoughts. Maybe he thought, it's a very small problem, I can deal with this myself. It's not an army of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, it's just one city. I can sort this out. You know, I've got the resources, I can do it. You know, he didn't see his helplessness. And just look for a minute where the treasure, where the money comes from. Go back to chapter 15, verse 18. The silver and the gold in the temple come because Orsa's put them there himself. So he puts them there at the end of chapter 15, and then when there's a crisis a few years later, he takes them out again. He's kind of using the church of his own, as his own personal, or the temple, as his own kind of bank. He's sort of, I think the problem with Orsa, he'd given them, but he'd not given them away. And a real gift comes without strings. There's risk in giving real gifts. You don't know what's going to happen to the gift. You know, once we've given, it's out of our control. I wonder, question to ask ourselves, how do we feel about the church and what happens in it because of what we've given to it? Do we belong to it, or do we in some way own it? Or are we consciously always trying to give control, you know, over it to God? Whose church is it? Let me just wrap things up. As the days get a bit lighter and get slightly warmer, I get out in the garden. And one job is removing weeds. You know, it might have been, you know, cold and dark in the winter, but actually, however cold it is, weeds keep growing. You know, in the summer, don't you? You're away a week or two, and weeds sprout up. Huge things sometimes. They don't stop. Turn your back and they're there. Weeds are a persistent problem. And the spiritual weeds of sin are like that. They don't go away. Orsa was a God-fearing man, but he had a fallen, sinful nature, and that didn't disappear. The seeds of sin were waiting to sprout inside him. The same with us. However strong we might feel we are as Christians, however long we've been Christians, whatever we might have done, however holy and committed we might be, sin is there waiting to sprout and seize us if it has the opportunity. So do we despair? No, despair is what the devil wants. What gives us hope is the nature of the gospel. If we really understand our faith, you know, we don't worry about this. You see, we're not just saved by the undeserved love of God and the grace of God. We continue as Christians by the love and grace of God. You know, we enter into our relationship. It's a free gift. But we continue on the same basis that it's a free gift as well. You know, I think sometimes people become Christians by grace. Oh yes, I understand all that. But they live by law. I'm saved freely, but only if I keep doing the right things and avoid major sins, and I keep going to church and I keep reading the Bible and I keep praying a lot, only then will God love me. It all depends on all those other things that I do. I'm in freely, but I've got to really work really hard. Otherwise, God might zap me and I might be out of all this. That's not grace. In the way that that works as well. Sometimes people, they do all those things and they're living by law and not by grace, and they kind of build up a sense of entitlement. I've done these things, God owes me one. You know, I've been God, you've got to bless me. You know? And actually, when problems come, you then get angry with God. Why have you done that, God? I don't deserve this, I've done all the right things. I wonder if that was also a bit. He'd given those gifts to God. He'd been a good man. He kind of felt God owed him one. He was entitled to use God. In the end, we continue as Christians, not because of our commitment to God, but because of the strength of his commitment to us. And that commitment is absolutely unshakable. Our eternal security is in God and what he's done, and above all, in Jesus Christ and what he's done. Let's pray.